What is happening, team? Coach Ishak with HockFit Coaching and Legion Athletics and your host for today's episode of Anabolic Radio. I'm joined today by Dr. Eric Helms. Those of you who are unfamiliar with him, you're missing out. Go give him a follow on social media and check out his work. He was previously on Anabolic Radio where we spoke about everything related recovery and managing stress and auto-regulation. So I definitely recommend you go give that episode a listen, as it's still super valuable, and recovery is literally like the biggest overlooked component when it comes to program design. Eric, I'm sure you could agree. And going into this episode, we're going to have another juicy one for you. We will be speaking everything related to optimizing exercise selection, specificity, proximity to failure for maximizing hypertrophy, intelligent exercise selection, the list goes on. And without further ado, the floor is yours. Eric, how are you doing today?
I'm better now that I'm talking to you, Ishak. Thank you for having me back on.
Yeah, Ianni. We were chatting a little bit before the episode started, and we were speaking about, you know, different things related to Eric's progress within the past couple months. And we spoke about how he was previously doing some Olympic lifting and then his foreseeable future and return to the stage in 2023. Eric, could you give us some insight into your offseason, how things are currently going?
Yeah, man, they're going really well. So I pursued Olympic lifting for the better part of 2020, well, up to maybe August or so. And then for the last year, culminating into our unfortunately canceled New Zealand Nationals, I've been focusing on powerlifting and achieved a lot of goals I had set out. I squatted over 500 pounds for the first time in my fake garage nationals that was on the same day as when it got canceled. But hey, I'm not going to let, you know, silly thing like a competition prevent me from getting canceled, prevent me from pretending to compete. And then, you know, in my competition qualifying for nationals, I pulled a deadlift PR and got a total PR. So overall, it was very successful. Most importantly, I didn't get hurt, which is the key to success in lifting. At least I didn't get seriously hurt. And now I'm really excited about the prospect of getting back on stage. I really enjoyed 2019. When I turn 40, believe it or not, in 2023, that's when I plan to get back on stage. And hopefully at that point, we're going to have, you know, more people competing, more shows, and less barriers as we hopefully get further along past the COVID pandemic. But anywho, my training's going great. It looks very different to what it was. Of course, now I'm primarily focused on bodybuilding with just enough specific work to maintain a fair amount of my strength so that when I do shift back towards strength-focused work, I don't have to rebuild the whole damn building, but I have the foundation at least remaining.
Nice. And we're all excited to follow along. Biological age of 40, but still looking like you're 20. So jumping into today's topic, you know, we previously mentioned how we're going to speak about everything related to exercise selection. So to start off this discussion, generally how I like to approach educating people about this topic is thinking of getting them to think from a perspective of efficiency and effectiveness, because our goal in the gym should always to be to get the most bang for our buck. Now, with regards to resistance training, something that I generally always like to say is it depends on your training level of advancement, because for what's appropriate for an advanced individual is not going to be appropriate for a beginner, and what's appropriate for an athlete is not going to be appropriate for a general population person just trying to lose some body fat and build some muscle. Now, generally, what I like to tell people is no matter the structure of the program, you always like to prioritize the six main compound movements. That's going to be a horizontal push, horizontal pull, vertical push, hip hinge, and a squat variant. And then depending on your training level of advancement, you could add isolation-based movements here or there, and then that'll eventually improve or climb in addition to your approach as you grow in regards to your level of advancement. So, Eric, the floor is all yours. How can we go about efficiently choosing the best exercises in the gym?
Well, first off, I think that was a fantastic preamble that you could have taken the words right out of my mouth there, because that's exactly how I start as well. I think if we're talking, I mean, this is anabolic radio. So I'm going to assume we're talking to people who are looking to get jiggity jacked and don't want to talk back about that goal. Yeah, because obviously if I was talking to someone who said, hey, I want to get as much muscle as possible, but I only train 2 days a week, we probably wouldn't be doing isolation movements. You know, we would probably also be taking a lot of sets to failure because we're going to have a hard cap on the time invested, which means there's a hard cap on the volume and frequency, which means we have the opportunity to invest in proximity to failure, or quote unquote intensity. And we don't want to waste time on things that don't provide quite as much bang for buck on a time based investment. However, for the anabolic listeners who are looking to get as jacked as possible, it comes down to, okay, what is closer to quote unquote optimal? And in this case, now we're often talking about training 3, 4, 5, maybe even 6 days per week. We're assuming the person has a fair amount of time to invest in the goal of bodybuilding. And even someone who takes bodybuilding very seriously, I mean, there are people at the highest level, we're talking winning their class at Pro Worlds, who sometimes only train 4 to 5 hours a week. Is that what most people have to do? They might have to do a little more than that if they want to get to that level. But nonetheless, compared to something like being a professional athlete in a real sport, rather than just trying to get the best pec striations in the game, then, you know, we're still training about half the amount of hours as those types of athletes. So totally agree on the efficiency front. And it often comes down to, while it's easy to say horizontal push-pull, vertical push-pull, hip hinge, and squat pattern, I think some people tend to be too narrow even in those definitions. When people hear squat variation, they think it's probably got to involve a barbell, maybe a safety bar. But I would think anything of a gait pattern, so your lunges, your split squats, anything using a machine, a leg press, basically anything that has simultaneous hip and knee extension can fit into that category, which is great for people who might have long femurs or poor dorsiflexion, or prior history of back injuries, or hips that always just seem to get frustrated when they do free weight movements. Similar for the hip hinge, that could be not just deadlifts, but also potentially a good morning, or even a weighted back extension or a hip thrust. So I think really you can think quite liberally with these exercises when the goal is hypertrophy. Because ultimately, so long as you're able to put a progressive tension stimulus on the muscles that you are attempting to grow, they will. Now, obviously, what defines progressive and ensuring, like we talked about in my last episode on here, that you're recovering from it to grow, there's a lot more nuance to it. But that's essentially one important point I want to add to what you said, is have a liberal interpretation of these movements, customize it to your availability, preference, what you find the least mentally fatiguing, so you can actually progress it, add volume when needed, have a relatively appropriate frequency, et cetera, et cetera. But you don't want something you hate, because you're just not going to want to push it and continually push it to make progress. And definitely want to find something that doesn't hurt you or has a low injury and pain risk, so that you can, you know, load a lot on top of it. You want a solid foundation to build from. So you want to really customize to your own biomechanics, preferences, and availability the exercises you choose for those six. Another thing I would say is that you also have to think about the amount of fatigue that each exercise provides. You know, a hip hinge and a squat pattern are fantastic, but they're not all created equal. If you were to choose to do deadlifts with controlled eccentrics, very viable motion, you know, for your hip hinge. But if, like I said, if you decided to do back extensions, maybe you're not training quite as many synergist muscles with the back extensions as you are the deadlifts. But at the same time, the deadlifts are probably going to leave you much more fatigued, both acutely for the rest of the session and even into multiple subsequent days, probably producing a little more muscle damage and a little more overall lingering fatigue that carries into other sessions. So you have to think about that as well. The trade-offs, the pros and cons, and the same could be said for certain squat patterns, you know, comparing a dumbbell split squat to a low bar back squat in different rep ranges, for example. You know we can train in the 6 to 20 rep range, but doing 5 sets of 6 or 5 sets of 12 are going to have slightly different stresses on the body.
Great points. A lot to touch on, and the devil is in the details. So I would like to talk about a bit of the nitty-gritty stuff. for those of you who didn't quite get it, you know, Eric previously mentioned, you know, there are going to be considerations with regards to your squat variance, such as your femur length, which is your upper leg length, for those of you who don't know those nerdy anatomy words, and also your ratio between your upper leg and your lower leg. And he also mentioned dorsiflexion, which just means the degree or amount of ankle bend that you're going to have in a movement. So those are among a few variables that you really have to take into account when it comes to optimizing your setup and your execution for movement. So for example, if I had a female counterpart next to me and her femur or upper leg is significantly longer than mine, she'll likely have an issue leaning forward a bit too much in a squat. That could be either related to her ratios between her upper leg or her lower leg, or related to her ankle mobility. So a solution would simply be, you know, elevating her ankles a couple inches, and that would be sufficient enough for her to achieve a good range of motion or enough knee bend to make the movement more quad. So those are among a few variables to be taking into account. And Eric, you had mentioned volume, frequency, and intensity, and each of those are really important variables that have so many talking points to touch on. So to put it simply, for volume, obviously we know that there's a huge individual variance with regards to how person A would respond and how person B would respond. And from the literature, we know that if we want to maximize hypertrophy, we need anywhere from 8 to 10 sets per muscle group per week. But that's not taking into account the individual variance. So would you be able to give us some guidelines for how we could individualized volume requirements?
Absolutely. And this is probably going to, well, not even probably, it will absolutely interact with your proximity to failure and your frequency of training. So ultimately, the way to best start and set up a program is to think about a target volume you want to get to. Think about the number of days per week you can invest in training. Think about the equipment you have available to you. Think about the way you want to train, and then you start to see how it fits on paper. So let's say you're someone, and this is, I'll use an example because it's probably the best way to go through how this thought process might work. Let's say you're someone who can invest 4 days per week of training. You don't have a really solid training background to know, well, how many sets should I do as a starting guideline? So a decent recommendation is to start kind of in that low end of what you said, maybe 8 to 10 sets per muscle group, because that's more than likely going to be sufficient to induce growth. It's possible that you might respond more optimally to higher volume, or potentially even lower. That's the way individual differences work. But the playing the odds is, hey, you know, we'll start on the low end of what is optimal in the literature, which is primarily based on lesser trained people than I. So it's a decent guess. Okay, so we're doing 8 to 10 sets per muscle group. We're spreading across 4 days. Then we need to think about, okay, how much time do I have to invest in each session? And how quickly do I get fatigued or burn out? Okay, so if I'm doing a lot of compound movements, I got about an hour and a half before I'm starting to burn the candle at both ends, proverbially. So, okay, maybe I will do a upper-lower split, and that'll enable me to get, you know, 4 to 5 sets per muscle group split between those 2 days. Because there is such a thing as doing too much in a single session. Essentially, this is just the question of quantity and quality. If you were to try to do 10 sets of squats in a single session versus, say, 5 sets of squats in 2 sessions, most people would say that they'd be able to maintain a higher load, do more reps, or just more mental focus, or just have less masochism and self-hate if they were to spread it out across 2 days, because 10 sets of squats in a single day is just bloody hard to do, hard to stay focused, hard to maintain form, and hard to perform. So you start having to make logistical, structural considerations based on the availability of your days and the exercises you have access to and what you like to do. And just because maybe you do have long femurs and not very great ankle mobility, maybe you want to squat. That's okay, right? Hell, like if you look at Kimberly Walford, who is arguably one of the greatest powerlifters of all time, when she gets to the bottom position in a squat, she's pretty much folded in half, you know? And that's because of just her structure. But she's still a very strong squatter. We're talking someone who can squat, you know, 374 pounds at 150 151, 152 pounds body weight. So you can definitely get better. You can definitely get stronger. The question is that a great movement for bodybuilding for you when you're not getting that many degrees of knee flexion compared to someone who has different mobility? Maybe not. So maybe you instead decide to do, you know, feet forward Smith machine squats with a heel elevated, you know, something like kind of like you recommended. But maybe you don't. Maybe you do decide, I want to have squats in my program. Well, okay. How many sets can I do? I don't want to go too close to failure. And then when I do come back for my second lower body day in this 4-day split, 3 days later, I will probably need to choose less demanding exercises because I'm going to be relatively fatigued. My back will be achy. I'll be coming into that session with a fair amount of fatigue. So that's kind of the way it looks. You need to think about what exercises you're going to slot on each one of those days. And then, you know, basically the closer you are to failure, the more volume you do, and the more range of motion and the more tension that's developed at long muscle lengths are all going to contribute to how much delayed onset muscle soreness and muscle damage you have, which can interfere with the performance and therefore the tension you can put on a muscle in your next session. So you will make different decisions if, say, you were doing something like a deadlift where you were producing high torques at long muscle lengths versus something like a back extension where you're producing high torques at short muscle lengths, and you're typically working with a lower risk movement. So you could probably do back extensions in relatively close proximity to another day where you train the posterior chain. But if you had a hard deadlift session, you're gonna be hard pressed to have a maximally effective workout within the next 72 hours that trains the same muscle groups. So there's different decisions to be made about an RDL versus a hamstring curl versus a shoulder press versus a lateral raise, even though they have some very similar characteristics and from a very basic perspective, train the same muscle groups. So in terms of volume, I think it always is best to, when you don't have individual data to look back, to start at the lower end and then think about how you would distribute that in the way that keeps the fatigue level mitigated and allows you to perform in each individual session across the number of days that you have.
Beautiful answer, beautiful answer. And to dive into, you know, a route very similar to this is specificity. So we're not trying to demonize squats per se, but for the goal of specificity, are we doing more powerlifting or Olympic lifting style training? Or are we doing more bodybuilding specific training? So if we're doing more bodybuilding specific training, there are or potentially are some other movements that we could be performing: squat patterns, pendulum squat, Bulgarian split squat, goblet squat, pit shark, leg press, you name it, that could potentially be better options of exercise selection other than a squat, because a squat per se, you know, could potentially be, you know, too fatiguing in the lower back. So if a squat is too fatiguing in the lower back, that's going to make the lower back a limiting factor in that exercise before you're able to train the lower body musculature to a greater degree. So these are some of the considerations you need to be taking into account when it comes to exercise selection. Now, Eric, we know how important selecting, you know, movements that fit for us, quote unquote, for those of you that are listening that didn't hear me say that, is how important that is. But for some of our anabolic listeners who are trying to maximize hypertrophy, we know that different exercises are difficult at different portions of the range of motion. So an exercise, you know, for example, could be hardest in the short position. It could be hardest in the lengthened position at those longer muscle lengths. And it's not that we should not be selecting movements that only train the short position, only train the lengthened position. We know that there's value to be gained out of a variety of movements. So what are some guidelines you could provide the audience for optimal exercise sequence? And obviously we know there's no optimal, but, you know, a good guideline.
Absolutely. So for sequencing, I think it's important to understand, just like you said, that there are trade-offs when you select different exercises. Everything's pros and cons, which is a good thing to always remind yourself when you do something like ask, what's better, X exercise or Y exercise? That is already a question that's typically not that helpful because it ignores the fact that there are trade-offs and pros and cons, and you might make a different selection for a different person if you're a coach, or in different instances, even if you're just working with yourself. So for example, a squat, while it does have an element of instability, which is not helpful for hypertrophy, It does require us to train synergists. It produces co-activation and isometric contractions throughout the whole body to a greater degree than something like a leg press. So like you said, the leg press probably won't produce much lumbar fatigue, but it's also not going to produce much, you know, lumbar core stabilization or in some limited hypertrophy there. Is that a worthwhile trade-off? A lot of times, if your goal is bodybuilding, then yeah, sure. Because the amount of effective growth you're going to get from something like the stability in the lumbar from a squat is probably going to pale in comparison to you training it directly with an RDL or a good morning or a back extension, et cetera. But it may not always just not be worth it at all. So those are things to consider. So if we understand that there's pros and cons with each exercise, we also understand that a lot of those pros and cons are related to the fatigue generated from an exercise and the mental focus required and the injury risk required. So generally, when you're sequencing exercises, assuming we're not trying to specifically address a weakness or we're not dealing with a outlier case of an individual needing to train something first for whatever given reason, generally you want to go from complex to simple, from high risk to low risk, and from compound to isolation within a given session. You also probably want to err on the side of minimizing acute fatigue from exercise to exercise, and emphasizing performance generally. There are exceptions to that because fatigue in certain instances is basically how we actually stimulate muscle. But you wouldn't, for example, want to say to do leg extensions, hack squats, and squats all back to back to back. If you also had hamstring curls and calf raises, it might be a good idea to insert those two between those three exercises. And that's just an example of how you would give yourself some time to recover before then you went fatigued into the next exercise. Because fatigue can be generated by different pathways. Local muscular fatigue, that's great, because that actually means that other fibers have to come into play to keep producing force, and it gives a training stimulus. However, the examples I gave of a squat and a hack squat, those are both very fatiguing full body movements. They have quite a cardiovascular debt that you're going to have to pay. So when you're producing kind of this global effort and you're actually out of breath, that can create a fatigue that actually limits your ability to perform and can happen at in centrally mediated effects that reduce your ability to actually recruit muscle fibers. So you'd really don't want to have a session that turns into an aerobic workout. You don't want to be risking throwing up. You don't want to be so out of breath that you're not sufficiently recovered cardiovascularly between sets. And if you think about your exercise sequencing, especially on leg days, this is where this is a problem, where if you go into the session, you're like, oh, I got hack squats, deadlifts, and I got squats today. You're going to have to think, is that the best way to distribute those movements?
This is why some.
Exactly, right? So you need to either be in great shape. It needs to be like a two-hour session where you take massively long breaks. And if you look at most powerlifting workouts, especially in a volume phase where someone is also doing a lot of accessories, squat days and deadlift days take multiple hours. Is that the most efficient way to train? No, that's what they have to do to maintain performance. But if your goal is to accumulate volume and to be progressive and to train every muscle group effectively, then you really have to think about those leg days. Does it make sense to only train legs once a week and to primarily use compound movements? A lot of the times you start being on the short end of that stick. So in these instances, you need to think about sequencing especially and probably limiting the number of compound free weight lower body exercises you have to maybe two and at most three on any given day. That is a lower body training day. And then distributing the rest between less fatiguing exercises. But generally, complex, high risk, more muscle groups trained to less complex, less risky, less muscle groups trained. And then thinking about how to alternate movements so that you are not going into the next exercise carrying unnecessary fatigue.
Great summary. A lot of good points, a lot of gems in there for people to touch back on. So now that we have our exercise selection optimized, Kitty, hello, jumping on the desk. Now that we have our exercise selection optimized and, you know, our exercise sequence is in a really good spot as well, everything looks good, but we don't know how to work hard. So this is something I always like to say is that you could have the best training program in the world. Everything could look 100% great, but it doesn't mean jack if you don't know how to apply that program intelligently and make it work for you. The common denominator regardless of the training program, is always going to be effort and how you're able to sometimes take exercises to a close degree of failure. Now, obviously, training to failure is a skill. And before you take an exercise to failure, you need to be efficient with how you set up and execute your movements. And you really want to ensure that that is standardized, because potentially sometimes in some cases, depending on the exercise, when you take it to a close proximity to failure, you could be increasing your risk of injury. So that's why it's so important to standardize your setup and execution, because once it's ingrained, you're decreasing your likelihood of getting injured once you add another variable to the equation, i.e. load or weight. So, Eric, with regards to optimizing hypertrophy, how important is it to work hard and or take our sets to a close proximity to failure?
Yeah, it is easily one of the most important variables. You know, we often talk about the importance of volume, but volume is a quantification of total work. And most people don't count the volume of like their warm-up sets. And there's a reason for that. Because they don't feel like that volume, quote unquote, counts. Why? Because the effort's not there, right? If you can do a set of 315 for eight, doing 225 for five, how far are you from failure? You're probably like 15 to 20 reps from failure, right? So did that do anything? It probably did something, but is it sufficient enough to actually stimulate gains in someone who can actually squat 315 for eight reps? Probably not. So we have to consider, at what point do we start actually stimulating gains? And then at what point do we get a maximal stimulus? Well, if you were only going to train once, you'd want to get the most out of that session as you possibly could. And this is why I understand the mindset of people who go just take everything to failure. Because if you kind of narrow your view to look at a single session in isolation, then you want to get the most out of your body that you physically can. And if you consider the things I said before about exercise order and exercise selection, then the next obvious thing to do would be able to take every set to RPE 10, you know, go to failure. Why not? So long as it's safe, you got a spotter, because that would get the most out of every single one of those sets, you know, case closed. However, if you're going to come back, like I said, if there's a limit to the amount of volume you can do effectively in a given session, then you might going to need to have some type of distribution of it over the week. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have an upper lower split. It could be I do some hamstring curls on my upper body day, you know, because I'm trying to get to that certain target and that's a focus. You could even have a bro split where you only train everything roughly once per week, but you would still need to think about how does that given day affect subsequent exercises. Because, for example, if you were to take 225 on bench, and let's say you can do 10 reps with it, and that's it. If you did 10 reps, the next set you'd probably get 7 or 8, depending on how long you rested and how good you are at recovering. And the next set you'd probably get 5 or 6. However, if you just did 8 or 9 the first set, you could probably continue to do 8 or 9 every set, and you'd end up having about 10%-ish more volume at the end of those three sets. And the question is, well, was it better to get 10% less volume but be at a high proximity to failure? Or was it better to be a little short of failure and get more volume? Our best guess is it's probably better to do the latter. There is a point at which proximity to failure is not giving you any more benefits. And that point is still being determined, but ultimately it's better to think about how do I get in sufficient effort that allows me to reach my target volume and progress over time. Because we have plenty of data to suggest that training to failure is not better than training just short of failure for hypertrophy. Okay, if those are relatively equal variables, getting within a reasonable proximity to failure, but going closer to failure elongates the recovery time and increases muscle damage, then there's a trade-off there. I might have to deload more frequently. I have to might limit my volume. I have to might choose different exercises that I wouldn't normally. Might have to limit my frequency, which all could potentially be something that would be beneficial. So while you absolutely can make your typical bro split, which I would describe as a moderate volume, low frequency, high effort program work, and it could even be within what I would probably describe as optimal, it limits your options if it is not optimal for you. So if you try the bro split and you start to plateau and you feel as though you could handle more, but you are absolutely just wrecked at the end of each one of these sessions, but globally, you don't necessarily feel like you're overtraining or anything like that, that's when it might be a good idea to switch to something where you train muscle groups more than once per week, which then you start to think of, well, how do I do that when it takes me 5 days to, you know, not have, you know, quad DOMS anymore? Well, we reduce the number of exercises on that given day, and maybe we only go to failure on like the last set for that muscle group. And that's the type of perspective you have to take. But it's very difficult to know if you're two or three reps shy of failure if you've never actually gone to failure. So I do think there is value for most lifters to go through a phase where they do a moderate or even low volume program with a high degree of effort where they're pushing most sets to a 9, 10, or even past failure, so long as they've got a spotter and a training partner, so they can develop the skill of knowing what their limits are so that they can actually stop just short of them. And I think that's something that needs to be said more often. It's easy to say, hey, most of the time train between the 7 to the 9 RPE and maybe on single joint isolation movements at the end of an exercise, train to a 10. But if you've never trained to a 10 regularly, that's a difficult thing to do.
Great points. So there's a couple things I want to talk about. There's a couple routes we could go. Basically, to summarize what Eric said, guys, is you need to be taking every set of every exercise to failure. I'm just kidding. But if you do that, you'll find a limit of where your recovery lies, and then you could go listen to our episode on recovery. But just to break off into what you were saying, Eric, guys, you do have to understand that there are different types of failure as well. There's, you know, technical failure where you fail in a movement related to your execution or your setup. There is mechanical failure where you either lose range of motion or the inability to contract the target tissue. That's true muscle failure. When you're training to failure, that's generally what you're looking for. And, you know, obviously there's different types of failure, like extended failure in the form of like drop sets that I'm sure many people are pretty familiar with. So would you say proximity to failure also varies based on, you know, compound versus isolation exercises as well?
Yeah, I think the definition is really important. So momentary muscular failure is the point where you actually can no longer complete an exercise. That's, you tried the curl, you got stuck halfway and you missed. That's actually the repetition after a 10 RPE or a 10 or a 0 RIR. So RIR, repetitions in reserve, RPE, rating of perceived exertion, if it's based on RIR, is based on how many you can do, not based on the actual point of failure. So a 10 RPE means I couldn't have done another rep, which means the next rep would technically be where failure is. Now, there's also technical failure, which is where there is certain objective defined technique for the exercise, where if you don't adhere to it, you don't consider that rep. And the point at which you can no longer perform the exercise to that technical standard, then you count that as failure, even if you could move the bar or the weight stack or what have you from point A to point B. A good example of this would be curls. Again, if you had to heave your lower back and lean back to get the curl to go up, and if you hadn't done that, you wouldn't have got it. That is going past technical failure, but you didn't actually reach that point where you couldn't complete the range of motion. So generally, since our goal as bodybuilders is to train certain muscles, we don't want to alter the biomechanics of a lift to complete a range of motion, because now we're actually doing, we're targeting different muscles now, right? We're not necessarily trying to get a explosive concentric, you know, lumbar contraction during our curl. We're trying to target the biceps. So that is not necessarily a technique that we would use out of the gates. Another argument you could make, though, is minor deviations in form probably aren't bad as you go close to failure. Think of a squat where you're able to stay relatively upright, and then as you get towards the end, it gets a little more good morning-y, right? Is that really a bad thing? Maybe you've successfully stimulated your quads through the first two-thirds, three-quarters of that set, and then towards the end, now you're bringing your glutes more into play. Okay, great. So you got some glute hypertrophy. Ain't nothing wrong with that. But I do think there needs to be some line in the sand where you draw that. And like you said, there's also risk versus reward. As you have involuntary biomechanical shifts closer to failure, and sometimes putting certain joints at a greater relative risk than others, you have to ask if that's worth it. Do I really want to push compound free weight movements to failure? Is the risk worth the reward? And I would probably say in most cases, no. Especially since we know certain things about compound free weight movements. They generally train at a high tension, at a long muscle length. If you think about the bottom of a squat, that's when your glute and your quad is maximally stretched, and it's also when the squat is the hardest. So that means that we don't necessarily have to push really close to failure. We're already generating very high tensions through a full range of motion. Fantastic. We also know from EMG studies that even at low loads closer or further from failure, the prime movers in compounds are achieving very high activation levels. So they're great exercises for the prime movers. And are we going to use them to try to get a little bit out of our synergists? That's not typically the approach bodybuilders take. We round out our sessions with additional exercises. So for those theoretical reasons, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to push our compound free weight movements, especially, to failure. So I think those are exercises where we want to probably stay in like the 6 to 9 RPE range, or, hey, I could have done 1, 2, 3, or maybe sometimes even 4 more reps, depending on the movement, depending on what else I'm doing, depending on the phase of training, et cetera, et cetera. But then as we move into more controlled environments, as you move from a compound free weight movement, let's say like a squat, to a compound machine movement, where now there's less degrees of freedom for you to shift. You're probably going to not get to a point where you're not training your quads on a leg press. It'd be an impressive feat of acrobatics to somehow could do a leg press without training your quads. Okay, now we can push it a little closer to failure. Do we want to go all the way to failure? Maybe, maybe not, because it still shares some of those same things with squats. It's still high levels of tension at a long muscle length. It's still a compound movement. We're not really trying to get a little bit of extra hamstring stimulus out of a leg press. So maybe we go closer to failure, but not regularly all the way to it. And then we leave the failure training to the isolation movements, which often also don't train you at long muscle lengths at high tension levels. So even though you're going to failure, which tends to increase muscle damage, it won't be to the same degree if you'd gone to failure on a movement that trained at high tensions at long muscle lengths. If you think about a leg extension, the point where the fulcrum is the longest distance from the lever, that's it, full knee extension. That's not necessarily when the muscle is at its longest state. It's when it's at its shortest state, right? So you have the opportunity to push those sets to failure without necessarily inducing a whole ton of damage. So another way to look at that is, okay, I'm going to do 3 sets of 6 on squats between a 6 to 8 RPE. I'm going to do 10 to 12 on leg press at a 7 to 9 RPE, and then I'm going to do 3 sets of 12 to 15 on leg extensions at an 8 to 10 RPE, finishing that last set, me actually pushing all the way to failure. That's going to enable you to get a lot of effective quad stimulus, 9 hard sets with multiple exercises. And I'm going to talk about some other benefits of having two different types or multiple different types of exercises, rather than going to failure on that first set of squats and kind of having everything else turn into this montage of blood and tears and sweat and puke, where the quality is questionable and the risk is high. And there's no way in hell you're going to train legs again that week. While there is a possibility that you might be able to have another session doing what I described earlier, and that's still a hard workout, don't get me wrong, you know, squat, leg press, and leg extensions, your quads will be effectively trained. Here's the thing about compound movements real quick. The thing we have to understand is that if you don't have any knowledge or understanding of anatomy, you're going to always be a bit of a slave to just what kind of the articles say, or very simplistic thinking, like leg presses for quads. But if we have even just a cursory understanding of some of the anatomical realities of the way the body works, we can start to make better decisions. So for example, the quadriceps, quad, 4. Means there's 4 active heads or compartments of the quadriceps. One of them, called the rectus femoris, and again, this is in the language. It's beautiful if you think about it. Rectus femoris, it erects, if you will, the femur, meaning it not only does knee extension, it does hip flexion, bringing the femur closer to the body, right? So as I said, a squat pattern is something you would define as something where there's simultaneous hip and knee extension. But hold on, the rectus femoris does hip flexion. That's actually in contrast to hip extension. So the rectus femoris is what we would call a biarticular muscle. It crosses 2 joints, the knee and the hip, meaning that they shorten towards each other, meaning it can do both knee extension and hip flexion. So it's not in the body's best interest to activate this head of the quadricep when it's trying to also do hip extension. And we see this repeated over and over in studies, that the rectus femoris does not hypertrophy very well from squat exercises. It's not very active on EMG. However, when we do a knee extension exercise, a pure knee extension exercise without hip extension, like a leg extension or a sissy squat, it actually gets a lot of activation and grows quite well. So we have to understand to some degree that there are bioarticular muscles. And the big picture take home is that compound exercises alone are not sufficient to maximize muscle growth everywhere. You will see things like the long head of the tricep. Well, the triceps, we know that's the back of the arm. Primary purpose is to extend the elbow. They also extends the shoulder. And we can't be extending the shoulder when we're trying to flex the shoulder on something like a bench press. So even though the triceps are helping you at lockout, the long heads aren't contributing that much to that lockout because they would be counteracting the action of the front delts and the pecs. So that means we need to do some isolation work for our triceps. We need to do some isolation work for our quadriceps. We have a similar thing going on in the back of the leg too, the hamstrings. They're both hip extensors and hip flexors. And the short head of the biceps femoris is a knee flexor only. And knee flexion isn't something we want to be doing while we're trying to extend the hip. So that means we probably need to do some things like hamstring curls in addition to pure hip hinges. So if you're interested in maximal hypertrophy, there's a reason why we're not just doing deadlifts and squats or even hack squats and RDLs. You probably do want to include some knee flexion. You probably do want to include some leg extensions. And you probably do want to include some isolation work for your arms as well for all those reasons. And there are other reasons to include in other exercises. You can get even deeper. There are people who specialize in exercise selection and functional anatomy. But I don't think everyone should be expected to do that in order to progress. But you do need a basic cursory understanding that isolation movements are needed to some degree if your goal is to really maximize hypertrophy everywhere in the body.
Especially as an educator, you need to know your stuff. So there's a couple routes we could go. Beautifully said, chef's kiss, al dente. That was a great summary. And you know, for those of you who don't understand what he said, just to break down some of the language, he said biarticulate muscle. Okay, there's a few he referred to, and basically that's just a muscle that has two functions. It also crosses two joints. So one that he referred to is the hamstrings. So the reason why squats are a terrible movement for your hamstrings, you also see this in EMG data too. Hamstring activation is generally pretty low in a squat. But anyways, when you're in the bottom position of a squat, your hips are in a flexed or bent position, which means the hamstrings are technically lengthening, right? But we also look at what's happening at the knee, and our knee is also flexing or bending, which means the hamstrings are shortening, which means the length of the hamstrings isn't changing much, meaning it's doing an isometric contraction, meaning we need isolation exercises to help miss the areas of the range of motion that unfortunately a squat doesn't train for the hamstrings. Or, you know, a hip hinge. We could use an RDL. We could use a good morning. Whatever the case may be. Something that I also would like to point out is the common denominator that was referred to, okay, is proximity to failure. Not saying you need to be training to failure every single exercise for every single muscle group, but rather you need to build up the skill of training to failure. You need to take some movements to failure every now and then, and you also want to do it intelligently. So now that we're on the topic of this, you know, we tend to think of like, you know, training to failure is not going to have, you know, any sort of effect, but obviously based on our understanding of physiology and, you know, exercise science training theory, we know that, you know, there's different types of things that could result from too much stimulus or too much training or too much volume or taking your movements too close to failure. And that is overtraining syndrome. So obviously there is something called, or for those of you who don't know, there's different types of overreaching. Okay, basically we're just trying to take advantage of that last final week of hard training. And there is a type of overreaching that's called functional overreaching, and then there's non-functional overreaching. So Eric, could you help us, could you help the audience understand the difference between the two and some things they should be looking out for overtraining syndrome?
Absolutely. So I think overtraining is something that most people have heard the term, but not something super well understood. I very often get the question, hey, Eric, I'm doing X, Y, and Z. Is that overtraining? The beauty of true overtraining is that it doesn't happen without you knowing. The way we actually define overtraining, and the only one way that seems to consistently actually predict it, is Or is your performance going down or stagnating? And that is the actual definition of it. So overtraining syndrome, it accompanies other symptoms, things like poor sleep, changes in appetite, mood disturbance, depression, loss of motivation to train, pain, enhanced anxiety, all those things, in addition to having an extended multiple month period where you're either stagnant in your performance or getting worse. Now, I think the reason why bodybuilders struggle with the concept of overtraining is because they're probably not enough performance oriented. They think it's about stimulating muscle. I don't care how strong I am. I'm not a power lifter. And while your goal is not necessarily to get stronger, if you're increasing the cross-sectional area of your muscles, which contain contractile tissue, you will see your force production go up, which means you should be getting stronger over time. And if you're not able to add reps, and by the way, stronger doesn't mean increasing your 1RM. If you can't go from 7 to 8 reps with the same load, no increase in load at all, just being able to do another rep. Or if your 8-rep max doesn't go up, or if you in general aren't seeing RPEs go down if you don't change reps or if you don't change load, those are all different ways of expressing the fact that you're producing more force. And if that is not changing over time, it means you're probably not growing. And that could be for many reasons. That could be because maybe it's contest prep. You don't actually have the sufficient recovery. You don't have the calories or the amino acid support to actually grow. So you wouldn't expect to in that scenario. So that's okay. You know, so holding on might be the best you can have in that situation. However, if you're in the off season and if you're in a growing phase and you are eating sufficient calories, you are eating sufficient protein, and you are stagnant and you're not progressing, that's not a good thing. In fact, it's a sign that you're not progressing and that something needs to be changed in your training. So the definitions are overtraining syndrome, which I already described, less than that, and what's much more common in lifters. In fact, it's very rare that you see lifters who are actually experiencing true overtraining syndrome. That normally happens in combination with a caloric deficit, contest prep, or potentially if you're doing other types of training, like if you're doing lifting as a part of CrossFit, but you're really going bananas on volume, is overreaching. So overreaching can be classified into two different types. There is functional and non-functional overreaching. And to understand the definitions of these, we need to understand that training produces increases in fitness, and it also increases fatigue. And our actual performance, the output of what we can do, whether we could get 8 reps instead of 7 with the same load we used last week, that is a product of subtracting, if you will, your fitness from your fatigue. And if it's a positive number, you can see an increase in performance. Because if you are overloading, which is what's required to get an adaptation, you are producing fatigue and you're producing eventual chronic adaptations, that quote unquote increase in fitness. But the fatigue acutely will be masking your ability to perform. And that's okay. So non-functional overreaching is when you see a decrease in performance or stagnation in performance. And then when you do something like a deload or take a few days off to let fatigue dissipate, you come back to training and you're still plateaued or you haven't improved your performance. That's why it's non-functional overreaching. You pushed yourself to the point where fatigue actually masked your fitness, but it didn't benefit you. Functional overreaching is when you do that, you come back from your deload or you come back from your few days off and you're able to progress again. And the latter is something that's totally fine. And it might just be the description of what normal training looks like, especially like you said, when you're in your last week of a mesocycle, you're coming close to the deload phase, where you start to see performance actually go down or plateau, when in previous weeks it was slowly ticking upwards. Essentially, as you continue to overload, you're going to generate fatigue. You may not need to necessarily do this as a novice or an intermediate. The rate at which you're gaining fitness and the rate at which fatigue dissipates from doing so could allow relatively steady progress. And this is what we call newbie gains or even early stage intermediate gains, where basically for the first couple years of effective training, you're able to steadily progress even if it tapers off. Week to week, each time you come in the gym, you improve on at least a good chunk of your movements in a session. That's the experience of being an early stage intermediate and a novice, just differentiated by how rapid those increases are. And that's because you're getting so much fitness for every dose of training that the fatigue is not sufficient to mask it. However, an advanced lifter who might only be increasing their 8RM squat by, say, 15 pounds in a year or two, that fatigue can easily mask their fitness. That said, they're also more resilient. They're better at recovery. They have more fatigue resistance. So a lot of times this kind of looks very plateauy. There's a narrow band of performance. And therefore, you have to do things like, okay, I'm going to really push at this block, deload, come back, and then see if I've enhanced performance there, or if my RPEs drop down. But anyway, that is basically the distinction between overtraining, non-functional overreaching, and overreaching. And that is why it's important to manage things at the higher levels, like proximity to failure, volume per session, exercise selection, and the distribution of the total training dose over the course of the week, the microcycle, and also the mesocycle, multiple weeks.
Great points, man. And likely in either scenario, you guys will probably have to deload. So, you know, go check out the episode on recovery with Dr. Eric Helms once again. And beautifully said, Eric. And something that I wanted to, briefly discuss with you is, is tempo training. So, from a lot of the literature, we don't see that much of a difference with regards to emphasizing tempo training. But we know based on, exercise science that there are points in a movement and a range of motion where we'll have the most mechanical advantage and least mechanical advantage. Basically, there's going to be points in a range of motion, guys, where you're stronger and weaker. Okay. So these types of exercises will either load the muscle in its short position or in its lengthened or stretched position. So something that we were previously speaking about was squats and how, it's not really great for the rec fem, one of the muscles in your quads. And Eric had stated that, you guys need to maybe do some leg extensions to sweep, like you're sweeping the floor. When you sweep the floor, you don't want to sweep the same area. You want to sweep over the other area that's dirty. You want to sweep over the other point of the range of motion that's missed by that big compound movements, i.e. squats. So obviously we know from the literature, it says, or it demonstrates a certain standpoint about tempo training, but we know that practically, there are points in the range of motion that we could emphasize for more mechanical damage, or there are points in the range of motion where we could emphasize for more of a metabolic type training stimulus. Could you go ahead and give the audience some insight into tempo training?
Yeah, I think as you could get quite complex on manipulating tempo, but ultimately the practical application, I fail to see any time where it wouldn't just be control the eccentric and then put maximal force into the concentric. And to get at some of the things you were talking about of training at different or achieving different high tensions at different ranges of motion, that's pretty much just differences in exercise selection. The example I gave of peak tension occurring in a leg extension, a standard leg extension machine at least, occurring when you're at full knee extension, when the leg is straight, versus the peak tension on the quad occurring when you're in knee flexion at the bottom of a squat. That's an example. Whether that's actually complementary for that reason alone, that's something I'm not sure. I will say, though, that because of a squat requiring hip extension and knee extension simultaneously, you're not going to be training the rec fem very effectively because it's biarticular. So you probably want to include something that is not a compound movement that requires hip extension when you train your quads. And if you don't have access to a leg extension, by the way, there's a lot of ways to do this. You can do sissy squats. You can grab the side of the rack. First time you do it, maybe you're not that strong. It feels like kind of a crazy position to be in if you've never done it before, and just slowly lower yourself into position. There's also some great video. There's a great video, I think, in 2019 by the late, great John Meadows, where he shows how to do a modified sissy squat using a hanging ring apparatus, just ropes essentially, where you have your feet on the ground, your body's parallel to the ground, and you're rocking back and forward by basically doing like a leg extension on the ground and allowing your body to move backwards. So it's like a modified sissy squat, I guess. That's a great movement, and it lowers the demand on the knee and the strength requirements for the first time you do it. You can also do what you could call a reverse Nordic or a Nordic leg extension, where you're essentially moving from a kneeling position with your butt on your heels to then extending your body using your quads to get back up. Shortens the range of motion a little bit. It also changes where the tension is. So it's hardest when you're kind of sitting on your heels. So now it's a leg extension where you train at long muscle lengths. So there's a lot of ways to manipulate this. But I think for the most part, It will come in the form for the average trainee from, unless they have access to pretty specialized equipment or they want to start putting bands on machines or things like that, which I think is probably juice not worth the squeeze in most cases, is to have complementary exercise selection, control the eccentric, and this is especially important for hip hinging. Anytime you're lifting off the ground. So if you're doing a deadlift variant where the barbell starts on the ground, as you get more and more fatigued, it's very easy to do the eccentric, and I put quotes around do the eccentric, but instead just let gravity do the eccentric for you. And the data is quite clear that the issue with that is that you're not actually controlling it. So an eccentric contraction, and quotes around contraction because it's not actually shortening, is a muscle action where the muscle is lengthening while producing force. And if you're just letting the bar drop down to the ground, you're not actually producing tension or force during that phase. You're essentially cutting your volume in half. So while it might not be a bad idea at all for a powerlifter just to train mostly concentric only and just to let the gravity take care of it on the eccentric of deadlifts, because then it causes a little less damage, it's more specific, you're less fatigued, you can get more volume and practice the lift better. Maybe not at all phases. You might want to do during a volume phase, actually control the eccentric and maybe put a stimulus on your hamstrings. For a bodybuilder, you probably always want to control the eccentric on a deadlift. But that's easier said than done. If you're doing sets of 6 to 8 and controlling the eccentric on deadlifts, you're going to find that that doesn't always happen, even involuntarily. You can try, but it requires a lot of concentration. You're trying to pack your shoulders. You're trying to keep your lats tight. You're going to lose your position somewhere, somehow. So that's why generally you don't want to take things like deadlifts close to failure for bodybuilding purposes. Sure, a 1RM, of course, is a 10 RPE, so powerlifters, they know they need to. But for bodybuilders, training at like a 6 to 8 RPE on deadlifts and controlling the eccentric, that's probably how I'd recommend to do them. And then you can push other things that allow you to go, you know, close to failure while still controlling the eccentric, like a back extension closer to failure. So anyway, I kind of went off on a bit of a tangent there, but essentially tempo is a consideration we need to have in so much as we're stronger eccentrically. So by the time we reach concentric failure, if you think about this, like what is eccentric? What is concentric? Eccentric is lowering, concentric is lifting. So as you squat down with a barbell on your back, you're lowering the bar to the hole, then you're standing back up. The eccentric is the lowering phase. The concentric is when you stand back up. Generally, people miss it on the concentric. They can lower it with control into the hole, and then they get up a little bit, they get stuck, and they're glad they had a rack or they're glad they had a spotter. There's, of course, that one viral video of the 16-year-old kid who unracks the Smith machine with like 600 pounds and just immediately gets crushed out of camera view. But that's not generally most lifters, and that would be eccentric failure. That's not going to hopefully happen for you, and we don't want that to happen. Yeah. So the reason why I generally recommend control with the eccentric and then maximal force on the concentric is because you'll always be able to do more eccentric contractions. You'll be able to keep going. But we want to just make sure that the eccentrics we can get are under control, that it's actually our body doing it, not gravity. While the concentric, if the bar is not moving as fast as you could possibly move it, it means you're not pushing as hard against the bar as you possibly could, which means there's some fibers left on the table, essentially. Mm. So yeah, concentric, it might move slowly, but that's probably because you're either close to failure or you're training with a heavy load, and that's okay. But if it's moving slowly and you end up doing another 15 reps, that means that those early reps were not producing much stimulus and you're not getting as much out of that set as you could.
Mm. Great points. So to summarize what he said, guys, while the nuances of certain topics are always there and they're always emerging and it's good to think about them, is generally always best to be in complete control of the movement throughout the entire range of motion, especially the eccentric phase, especially the concentric phase, but most people shortchange the eccentric phase. Eric, I really want to thank you for your time and coming on. It was a pleasure talking to you, and you always make us feel so special with sharing your knowledge and your moral righteousness and your work ethic and just being a really good person, man.
Well, hey, if I can't be morally righteous, then what's the point of being alive, right?
Absolutely. I want to thank you again. And do you have any projects or, you know, resources you'd like to refer the audience to?
Absolutely. Yeah, man. That's all good. Yeah, I think if anyone does want to learn more about exercise selection or tempo, and how that interacts with volume, intensity, frequency, and everything we talked about. I've got books on the topic, The Muscle and the Strength Pyramids, where I have a full chapter on tempo, full chapter on exercise selection, and it is kind of reinforces and also links you out to the science for the uber nerds who want to read up on all this stuff.
Thanks so much for your time, Eric, and I look forward to having you on in a future episode.
My pleasure. I look forward to coming back on.
Cheers.